Blue Dot, Episode 17, Cascadia Rising.
This is Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem.
And I'm Matt Schiltz, and I'm scared.
You should be, because, you know, we're talking about a really large earthquake that is due, not in Southern California, not in the Bay Area this time. We're talking about Cascadia. And that's the subduction zone off the coast of Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. And that is due for a very large earthquake that could cause just utter devastation. We're talking about a magnitude 9.0. And they just did a simulation there in early June, simulating what would happen and how the government agencies would respond to it, called Cascadia Rising. And it involved governments from Northern California to Oregon and Washington and even Idaho, because this would be widely felt. It would even be felt here in the North State quite strongly, especially over on the coast.
Yes, civilian war games. That's why I'm scared.
It's exactly what it is. It's because, you know, you're going to need a big military response to an event like this. If you recall what happened to Japan in 2011, you know, we're looking at an identical scenario. Tsunamis hitting the coast from Northern California up through Oregon and Washington. A lot of coastal communities, you know, are in harm's way. And people need to be prepared and know what to do in order to minimize the loss of life and the loss of property.
And it's interesting because when you think of earthquakes, you don't think of tsunami. You think of the earth opening up, and you think of an action movie or something like that.
Yeah, well, that doesn't happen. The earth does not open up. You know, that's just a fallacy. And the kinds of earthquakes we have in California on the San Andreas Fault are not capable of causing a tsunami. But this particular area, this type of faulting, does cause tsunami, and we know that it's happened in the past. And we're going to be talking to Ken Hudnut from the United States Geological Survey about this. He's going to explain to us exactly how we know this has happened in the past and what we can expect in the future. And also, we're going to talk to Kristen Ludwig. She's a staff scientist for the United States Geological Survey, and she's involved in the Cascadia Rising earthquake simulation. Now, one of the things that's interesting to me is you think about the government agencies responding to all this and simulating it. You know, what if the governor, who in this scenario, the governor of Oregon, got up in a helicopter to pretend she's surveying the damage? Well, what if she's killed? What if you can't get gasoline to the helicopters? You know, all of these things need to be thought of in advance, because you're going to have major infrastructure disruption in an earthquake of a 9.0 magnitude.
All right, let's talk to Ken Hudnut.
Let's do that. Ken, we're talking today about Cascadia and the scenario of Cascadia Rising, a large earthquake, perhaps 9.0, on the Cascadia subduction zone. So the first thing I'd like to know is, can you tell us about the tectonic setting of Cascadia? How is it different from the San Andreas Fault?
Sure, yeah. So the San Andreas Fault is what we call a strike-slip fault, meaning that relative to the North American plate, the entire Pacific plate is moving toward the northwest, and so you have side-by-side lateral movement between those two plates along the San Andreas. And in contrast, up in the Cascadia region, what you have going on is that the North American plate is riding up and over the Juan de Fuca plate, which is being thrust underneath it, and so you have what's called a subduction zone. And where those two plates are scraping against one another, you have a very large fault surface area. The part of the fault that we're concerned with in a magnitude 9 in that area is what we call a megathrust fault interface, and it extends all the way from Cape Mendocino in Northern California all the way up to Vancouver Island in Canada, so entirely stretching along the coast from Oregon up along the coast of Washington, and it's a big long section, 600 miles plus long, and that whole thing could rip in one big earthquake.
Now, that would generate the same kind of scenario that we had in Japan in 2011, wouldn't it?
Very similar, yeah. We're looking at a similar magnitude, potential for a similar tsunami. So it's not just the earthquake. You'd have, for sure, in a case like this, you'd have a massive local tsunami and a Pacific Basin-wide tsunami generated by that earthquake. You could have submarine slumping that would make the tsunamis even worse. You could certainly have a lot of subaerial landslides, meaning on land. Those could number in the thousands, and you could have hundreds of separate landslide incidents that are equally bad to the Oso slide that occurred up there not long ago. So lots of landsliding expected, lots of ground failure like liquefaction along the coastal areas and low-lying areas. So we would anticipate quite a lot of ground failure, possibly even some surface faulting associated with some of the larger crustal aftershocks that we would expect to have happen too.
Now, when we talk about subduction, you know, one plate riding over the other and the other one sinking down, that's also responsible for our cascade volcanoes, isn't it?
Right. So as the Juan de Fuca plate is going down underneath the North American plate, it will melt. And so as it melts, that material comes up in blebs or drips upward, and that molten material forms the volcanoes in what we call the back arc setting. So, yeah, the Cascades volcanoes that we all get to see as we fly from California up to Portland or Seattle, those gorgeous volcanoes are pretty active, as we know from Mount St. Helens erupting. And the others also pose threats. So each has its own history of volcanic eruptions, and so the USGS Cascades Volcano Observatory keeps track of all of that activity.
I don't even have to fly to see them. I can see Lassen Peak and Mount Shasta just on my drive home every day.
Yes, and they're part of that same volcanic arc that's associated with the downgoing Juan de Fuca slab melting.
Tell us a little bit about the Cascadia Rising exercise that went on recently.
Right. So the Cascadia Rising exercise and the week afterwards, what was called the Ardent Sentry exercise, these were efforts by FEMA and the state emergency managers as well as the military and National Guard to practice how they would respond to an actual event of this kind. So these kinds of training exercises are very useful, and we find one after another that there are ways that we can, you know, there's always room for improvement. So that's what these exercises are all about, is to go through the steps of planning, how would we respond, and then go through the exercise to validate that plan. And then the hope is, and we know that this will work, is that if we do that and do lots of that kind of training and exercising, we're going to get better, so that if a real event occurs, all of us across the board know that we'll be that much better prepared and that much better able to help with the response and recovery.
And what was the exact, you know, in the scenario, what kind of magnitude earthquake were we simulating and what kind of aftershocks?
The Cascadia Rising main shock scenario kicked off with a magnitude 9 earthquake. And that was, of course, followed by the tsunami immediately, and then lots of aftershock activity as well. So people took that into account in the exercise and how they conducted it. On 2 days after the main shock, just for one example, we had a magnitude 7.1 aftershock along the coast down in Oregon. We had a couple of magnitude 5s on that same day right near Seattle, and then subsequently a magnitude 7.1 right near Portland. So, and then even later, another, you know, magnitude 7 up near Seattle. So these aftershocks are part of a sequence that was generated ahead of time before the exercise was conducted, and that aftershock sequence was constructed so as to be a very realistic one. And I think what was a bit of a surprise for many of the people conducting the exercise is just how many aftershocks and how jarring they are and how disruptive they are, because each time, you know, you have the main shock and everybody goes out and does damage assessments, and then when you have one of these larger aftershocks, you have to go do damage assessments all over again, and then another big aftershock, do it again. So each time you have to establish whether or not buildings are safe to enter, so there's this whole process of red, yellow, and green tagging buildings. And that has to be done over and over again, so it's very disruptive. And people are already worn out from all the extended effort to try to get things done fast, save lives after the main shock, and now each one of these aftershocks just sort of starts it all over again.
Can you briefly explain why a megathrust earthquake creates a tsunami, whereas the big one on the San Andreas does not?
Yeah, that comes back to the San Andreas fault slip motion being side by side, and also that fault is on land, except for north of San Francisco, of course, it goes offshore. But even there, it's side by side movement that doesn't necessarily generate a large tsunami. Whereas when you have the one plate going underneath the other, what happens in that case is that in between the times of earthquakes, for hundreds of years, you're loading energy into this upper plate as it's getting kind of dragged underneath. But then when it gets unstuck, it flips out, and the tip of the upper plate kind of kicks the water column and pushes this massive pile of water up above what we call the hanging wall or that wedge. And so when that wedge gets kicked upward, it displaces this enormous amount of water upward, and that's what starts the tsunami wave. So imagine along that whole 600 miles of the coast, and now imagine where the water is the deepest off the coast in what we call the trench. That whole water column gets lifted upward, and that starts the wave, and then the wave propagates out in both directions, creating both the local tsunami when the wave comes into the coast and also the basin-wide tsunami as that wave goes out into the Pacific.
How quickly would the tsunami waves get to the coast? How much time would people have?
It'd be 10 minutes in some places, more like 20 or 30 minutes farther away. So, and that's as the wave is coming into shallower water, it slows down. The wave going out into the ocean, into the Pacific, and into deeper water, as the tsunami is traveling across the Pacific, it's traveling at about the speed of a commercial jet. But as it's coming into on land, it's slowing down. And so that's a fortunate thing in that it gives people a little more time to get to high ground. People would have enough time to get to high ground. So what you would expect is to feel very strong, long-duration shaking, several minutes, maybe as much as 5 minutes of very strong shaking in those coastal communities. And so that would be people's heads up that they should start moving to high ground. They should not do things like drive along coastal roads because some of those coastal roads are close to the water level, and that's not a good idea. That we've seen that in many, many cases where people try to evacuate, but they only have roads that go along the coast, and so they get trapped and killed. So it's much better, instead of jumping in the vehicle and driving along the coast, to just simply hoof it and go up and get to high ground. That's a much safer move.
We know a lot about the scenario of this type of earthquake from the historical records in Japan, don't we?
Yeah, there's an amazing geological detective story in all of this, and many people deserve credit, but prime among them is a USGS scientist named Brian Atwater, who, along with his colleagues, really sleuthed out this incredible story from some clues that included Japanese records of what was called a ghost tsunami back in the year 1700 AD. So they knew that this tsunami had not been generated by an earthquake in Japan. They didn't know quite where it had come from. And so that was one clue. Another clue was that along the coast of Washington and Oregon, there were what were called ghost forests. These were places where entire large forests had been submerged and killed off because the roots had been dropped down into the salt water. And so at the time of a big earthquake, you'll have coastal submergence and uplift as well in some places. And so at the places where these estuaries existed and where there were some Native American villages, that earthquake in the year 1700 dropped the coastline down, dropped these entire estuaries down, and that's what killed off these trees. And so people had seen those, but it was the work of many people to do tree ring type chronology, radiocarbon dating, and then, you know, date these sediments. And so when the tsunami happened, it also brought in a big sheet of sand in 1700. So they were able to get radiocarbon dates on some Native American fire pits that were underneath that sand sheet. So that was another clue. And this was all put together and understood to mean that that earthquake in 1700 had generated the tsunami that was detected all the way over in Japan.
So we characterize the southern section of the San Andreas Fault as locked and loaded. This earthquake that you just told us about happened 300 years ago. Can we say the same thing now about Cascadia?
Yeah, in a way, it's a similar story where you have a fault that we do understand to be locked and loaded. It's locked, meaning that it's not creeping. We can measure with GPS, for example, how the strain is accumulating. And so we see that occurring both on the southern San Andreas and in Cascadia. So that's a real signal, and that is what occurs in between the times of big earthquakes as it's being loaded. So the fault is not creeping. That means it is locked, and it is being loaded by the plate tectonic strain. We can measure that with GPS. So, and we have this paleoseismic, paleo-tsunami evidence that's very crystal clear, showing us that in the case of the Pacific Northwest, a little bit more of that whole geological story. About 6,600 years ago, there was this massive eruption out of Crater Lake, so it just blanketed the whole area with volcanic ash, or what we call a tephra, and that's been precisely dated. And we know that there have been about a dozen of these big magnitude 9 class, or at least magnitude 8 plus kind of big earthquakes since 6,600 years ago. So it's not just one off in 1700. It's more like, well, this is just the norm that you have occasional big earthquakes. And so, yeah, it's been a few hundred years. The big one up that way will happen very soon, or maybe it'll be years or decades from now. But it is a real threat, and it's one that people need to be prepared for. So that's what this exercise was all about.
For us here in Northern California, far Northern California, would we feel intense shaking here?
Yes. So even in Northern California, the rupture would extend from Mendocino all the way on up to the north. So as the rupture went by, it would definitely shake things strongly throughout Northern California, especially in the coastal communities, Arcata, that way, along that section of the northern coast.
Ken, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That's Ken Hudnut. He's science advisor for risk reduction from the United States Geological Survey in Pasadena. And coming up next, we'll be talking to Kristen Ludwig. She's a staff scientist for the USGS, and she was involved in the Cascadia Rising simulation.
That's after a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And we're back, and we're talking to Kristen Ludwig. She is a USGS staff scientist who was involved in the Cascadia Rising earthquake simulation. Kristen, tell us about the simulation itself. How long went into planning this, and what was the outcomes?
The Cascadia Rising scenario has been in planning for several years, really, and the many people who have contributed to the planning document itself. And what the scenario is a magnitude 9 earthquake with a full 700-mile-long rupture along what's called the Cascadia subduction zone. And impacts would be far-ranging, including impacts to, we're really looking at Washington, Oregon, and Northern California.
And what are some of the effects that would be felt, like, say, in Seattle, Portland, Northern California, those coastal areas?
They're wide-ranging. It really portrays a worst-case scenario, and these exercises are designed to really test the system for response to see what works and what needs improvement. The impacts can range from widespread power outages to transportation systems such as roads, rail, and even ferry systems being affected, and even to impacts to our critical infrastructure, whether it's the schools that we use for assembling people who need refuge after an event like this, or local hospitals. There's additional impacts that can include cell phone communications and other communication lines that would be compromised during this type of an event. And so it's a pretty dire situation that would be portrayed in the scenario, and that's really the value of doing these exercises, is because we have a chance to hopefully walk through some of these things before it happens in real time, so that we can improve our preparedness.
What were the agencies involved in this?
The exercise itself is led by FEMA. The U.S. Geological Survey is one of many supporting agencies. And other ones can include Department of Transportation, NASA provides subject matter expertise, as well as NOAA and the National Weather Service. But it's really FEMA that's leading this, along with its many partners.
And was the military involved too?
Yes, they are, both on the federal level and then also on the state level in Washington and Oregon.
And the basis of the military involvement would be what, using the military to respond to the disaster?
Yes, and the military plays a key role in moving people and supplies and providing assets to support response. One of the things that was being done during the Cascadia Rising exercise itself in early June was different elements of the military were practicing their logistics, whether it's flying Black Hawk helicopters to move materials or practicing how quickly and easily they can set up emergency shelters. So that's something that they were doing as part of the exercise.
Let's talk a bit about the tsunami threat from an earthquake like this, because that's a major concern. This is going to be very similar to what we observed in 2011 in Japan, isn't it?
Yes, Japan is one of the closest analogs that we look to.
And so what kind of preparations do you go through getting coastal areas ready for that?
Well, one of the greatest challenges is that if we look just at the population alone in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California, there's over 70-some thousand people that are estimated to live in the tsunami inundation zone. For an event like this, evacuation time may be as short as 15 to 20 minutes. And that is not a whole lot of time to get to high ground. In terms of preparation, one of the things that can be done and is done in many of these communities is a lot of public education and sharing with residents what are the dangers and where can they go on their evacuation route, and ensuring that they know how to get there, how long it would take there during an event. There's also been some other advances in vertical evacuation. One of the lessons learned from Japan is that sometimes there isn't enough time to get to high ground, and so many of the survivors in Japan and hopefully in the areas here in the Northwest would be able to evacuate to higher ground in place, so up in the higher elements of their building, as long as the building can withstand the water inundation. And there's actually a new school that will be one of the first on the coast here opening its vertical evacuation zone this weekend. It's been retrofitted for tsunami dangers. That's Acosta Elementary School.
How high up would you need to go to be safe?
That's a great question. And the height that you would need to go to be safe really depends on where you are. For example, there's some places like in Aberdeen, Washington, where 70% of the population lives in the tsunami zone, and yet they're very close to high ground. In fact, most of their residents can walk within the amount of time that they would have to that high ground. However, there's other communities like Ocean Shores, for example, where 100%, all of their population is on a large plain that's pretty far from high ground. And one of the challenges there is that many of them would likely not have enough time to get all the way across and up to that high ground. And so that's something where you can really benefit from certainly practicing evacuation and from looking into options for vertical evacuation.
Finally, I saw for the shakeout scenario in Southern California, they were looking at a loss of life of around 1,800. Are there any kind of estimates for this event?
There are, and one of the concerning things about this is that there would be possibly over 10,000 fatalities. Now, most of those would be caused by the tsunami. probably be in the hundreds for the actual seismic event itself if you were attributing the cause of death for these, but it would be estimated over 10,000 fatalities and more than 30,000 injured.
Wow.
And in terms of economic loss, they estimate around $70 to $81 billion, and that's for Washington, Oregon, and Northern California.
Well, on that happy note.
Sobering, indeed.
That was Kristen Ludwig, staff scientist for the USGS on the Cascadia Rising Earthquake Simulation, a 9.0 megathrust earthquake along the coast of Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. It will happen sometime in the future.
And that's all we know for sure.
That's all we can say for sure, is it will happen. It's happened in the past repeatedly, and it will happen again in the future. It's the nature of the Earth's shifting tectonic plates. They build up strain, and they have to break at a certain point. It's not something that just might happen. It's something that will.
Why isn't that in the saying with death and taxes? I guess it's because
it's because they're so, it's just such a long-term thing. You know, geologic processes don't happen at the same rate that human processes do. You know, just to give you an idea, the earthquakes are caused by strain that's built up by the motion of the Earth's tectonic plates. And these huge slabs of crust are moving at about the rate, in California, they're moving at the same rate that your fingernails grow. I mean, you can stare at your fingernails all day long, and you're not going to see them grow. But you know, if you don't cut them, you know, after a month or two, you can see, oh yeah, my fingernails have grown. And that's what the Earth's crust does. And so over hundreds of years, you know, those fingernail growing rates go to 20, 30 feet. And that all has to happen all at once when the rock can't take that strain anymore and it breaks. And it breaks over a huge area and that causes a large earthquake.
And us in the valley here?
We're in a relatively seismically calm place. We really are. This is not a place where I would get terribly worried about earthquakes.
Because Kristen mentioned something about everything west of I-5 along this fault.
Yes, and we're talking about the coastal ranges. You know, that's where they would really feel devastating shaking. Here we would feel it. It would be a dramatic thing. It would wake you up. But it's not going to knock down your house or anything like that around here. So we're talking about primarily coastal regions and, of course, you know, the urban areas, Seattle, Portland, places like that. The places that worry me the most are all those coastal towns in Oregon, those beautiful places you like to go, especially in summer. And if you go there now, you do see tsunami warning signs and tsunami evacuation route signs are all over those places now because we know this is coming.
But now we're going. It's that time.
It's that time. Thanks to our guests, Ken Hudnut and Kristen Ludwig, both from the United States Geological Survey. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out our podcasts at mynspr.org. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom and Matt at
Matt Schiltz.
I'm reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.